Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 12th, 2010. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. But this week, it's the questions and answers from the National Homebrewers Conference panel you heard last week on this show, Going Pro. The owners of four commercial breweries share their experiences in what it's like to get a brewery up and running from the ground up. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter at Basic Brewing. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And you can find our show page at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show. And we appreciate your support greatly. And if you want to appreciate the people at Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association, we have associate links for them, too. So you can subscribe to Brew Your Own and become a member of the Homebrewers Association and get Zymergy, too. Both awesome publications. And now you can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on the iTunes Store. And yet another bit of news. Hello to BlackBerry users out there. This week I'm told a podcasting application launched for the BlackBerry. And I'm also told that this podcast, Basic Brewing Radio, was one of the first podcasts to be featured in the BlackBerry podcast directory. Now, we were one of a thousand, but that still counts. The first 1,000. So welcome to all you BlackBerry users out there who can join us on your favorite mobile device, at least more easily. I don't know. Could you listen to us before on the BlackBerry? I don't know. Welcome, and we're glad you're here. Spread the word to the other BlackBerry friends out there. But this week, I posted an episode of Basic Brewing Video as well. In this week's episode, Steve Wilkes talks to homebrew chef Sean Paxton behind the scenes of the National Homebrewers Conference Banquet. Sean and Steve talk about brining, in this case chicken, and beer. And you can find a PDF of a home-scale recipe that Sean put together just for us in this in the episode description of that episode on basicbrewingvideo.com. So be sure and take a look at that. And thanks to Sean for putting that together and for spending time with us at the National Homebrewing Conference as well. Great stuff. And I understand that Sean will be featured on a new show on the Brewing Network. So be sure to check that out. Sean is a smart guy, a very giving, talented individual, and a lot of fun to spend time with. So more kudos for Sean. Congratulations. His website, by the way, is homebrewchef.com. So check him out. If you want to spend some time with me, I'll be in Salt Lake City, Utah, for the second annual Beehive Brew Off on Saturday, August 21st. Let me check my schedule. Make sure I didn't make those plans for October. It's August 21st. That's not this upcoming Saturday, but the one after that. I didn't make it last year for the inaugural competition, but I will be there this year, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. And if you're entering the competition, the deadline is August 15th. So you only have a few days left. And we're looking forward to seeing the homebrewers in the now homebrew-friendly state of Utah. So be there. The state of Oregon, unfortunately, has become less homebrew-friendly as of late, as I'm sure you've heard. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission came out with an opinion that said homebrewers had to keep their beer at home, literally. Apparently, from what I heard, that means no sharing with friends, no competitions. There was a healthy 30-year tradition of homebrewing at the state fair there in Oregon, and no more till they can get it fixed. So they have some work to do in Oregon to undo the damage there. So there is some info posted on our show's Facebook page, and you can also follow the action at OregonHomebrewersAlliance.org. So it looks like everybody's on both sides are talking, and they want to work this out. So that's a good thing. So you never know. Don't be don't be too comfortable with your homebrewing legislation. It might go to heck in a handbasket there. So good luck to everybody up in Oregon. Travis Hammond, on more positive news, Travis Hammond, one of the organizers of the National Homebrewers Conference 2011 San Diego Conference, is gathering presenters for poster sessions for next year. Travis says poster session presenters will submit a brief 100-word abstract regarding their idea and prepare a poster using graphics, photos, and text, so the poster itself is self-explanatory, even if the presenter is not right there to explain it. Travis says posters will be displayed adjacent to the hospitality suite during the conference. In these sessions, brewers can share a technique they've developed or findings of research. So if you don't get into actually presenting in one of the sessions, you can do one of these posters in these poster sessions and put your idea up on the wall, and people can go and read them and get that information. I think it sounds like an excellent idea, sort of like a science fair for homebrewers. I think that's awesome. So for more information on that, go to facebook.com/NHC2011. That's facebook.com/NHC2011. Or you can email Travis at Travis Hammond. That's all one word. TravisHammond@hotmail.com. So get your idea. If you got an idea that's a good idea, it's not, you know, even if it's not good enough or big enough, expansive enough to host a whole hour-long session, make a poster with the idea, put it on the wall there, and people can see your stuff, get your information. I think it's a great idea. Now, this past week, you heard the speaker presentations for this panel that you're going to hear today, those speaker presentations. So if you're, you know, a BlackBerry user, if this is your first show, find last week's show and you can hear the actual presentations. This is going to be the question and answer section of the panel. We went over time, but it was lunchtime, so we just went ahead and kept talking right into lunch. And so who you're going to hear is Rick Garvin from Mad Fox Brewing, Tom Hennessy of Colorado Boy Brewing, Jay and Lori Wentz from Weasel Boy Brewing, and yes, Lori, actually, she gets to talk this time. Jay didn't stand in her way. And Omar Ansari from Surly Brewing as well. And like I said, this week the pros generously give a lot of their time to answer questions from the audience. Just kidding, Jay. We're not bumping up against another presentation after this, so if you guys can stay for a few minutes. And
I think 45 minutes or an hour is going to be enough for this.
Yeah, I figured the five-minute thing was ambitious to begin with. But all right, let's questions. What?
Omar, how long did it take you to get into the black?
How long did it take you to get into the black? And use the mic if you would, Omar.
Oh,
you guys
sure.
Share. It's
hello.
There you go.
To get us into the black took about a year and a half, but you know that was without me getting paid. And you know the big advantage for us was being self-distributed. We had 35% higher margins than if we sold it directly to a distributor. So those two things certainly helped. It took us probably a couple of years to really kind of get to a good spot.
Cans versus bottles.
It's Todd Haug, our head brewer, who I haven't really talked about, but a huge part of who we are, what we're doing, and the skills that he brought. So he was a big fan of cans, so he kind of brought it up, and I thought that was an awful idea. So I was the first person that needed to be convinced, and when we kind of looked at it, everything we've tried to do at Surly is try and don't just say, well, that's how it's been done, so we'll do it that way, but let's take a fresh look at it. So it was probably about 4 months into it, and we started looking at, all right, the brewery's up and running. We're kegging beer. We need to start packaging. And just looking at the low oxygen level, pickup levels that particular canning line had. So it was a pretty good way to package the beer. It doesn't get light struck, obviously. No one in Minnesota was doing it, which, is a huge plus because you've got to differentiate yourself in the market. I know I talked to some liquor store folks, and they're like, you know, I've got four aisles of craft beer, and they all look the same. They all come in six packs. So it was, you know, certainly something that made us a little bit different, got us into a different niche. And it was Todd Haug's wife, Linda, that owns Cafe 28, a great, I guess it's a gastropub in South Minneapolis, said, why don't you put them in Tall Boys? And once that idea came up, it all seemed to kind of make sense and come together. So it was about 6 months into our first year.
Oh, sure.
One thing, if you do ever get into this, and I'm sure Tom and Rick have already heard this. Rick has, you know, he's barely got product in the tanks, and Tom's done this for a long time. Everybody that walks through the door has got an idea, and that's fine. But the one question and the one comment we hear all the time is, when are you going to start bottling? When are you going to start packaging? I'm a seven-barrel brew house. It makes no sense at all for me to even think about packaging because I can't make enough beer to package and make it worthwhile. What am I going to do with seven barrels? How many cases is that? I mean, you know what I mean? So you got to have a production facility, in my opinion, to package properly. And because if you're going to be a packaging brewery, I think you have to be a packaging brewery, which is what OMR is. We're all brew pubs. I mean, we can do growlers, and we could do special hand bottlings and stuff like that. But to get into what he's doing, we don't have the – we're not set up for it. So we just always say, when you're going to start packaging, we say, well, not while I own it. So, you know.
On packaging, growlers cost me $12.50, not including the shipping. And you have to buy them in lots of 355. So that's the nice swing top ones. Growlers are great. And once that's purchased, that package gets reused over and over again. Packaging also takes up a lot of space. And at $31 a square foot, it's expensive.
Formal training in business or brewing? Brewing.
Well, funny you should mention that. We do offer a one-week immersion course at our brewery. But the truth is, I mean, I started brewing professionally, and about 4 years after that, I went to Siebel to perfect. But no, you don't. If you're a home brewer, if you're brewing, I'm not talking packaging. But if you're pub brewing, you're just home brewing with better equipment. Our mash tun uses a homebrew false bottom, which compared to the V wire and everything I've had, this copper I scavenged and sliced the bottom. I don't even Vorloff. It's perfect. It's a total homebrew thing. My efficiencies are great. My yields are great. You know, if you've got a passion about brewing and you read a lot of books, and you're clean and methodical. You'll just continue to improve doing your yeast cell counts, things like that, but you don't need to start. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page. We know, well, three of our good friends that have brew pubs in Columbus, Ohio, they've all been formally trained. One UC Davis, one Siebel, and I take that back, two of them have been formally trained, and the other one came up through a chain system and is a very good, talented brewer. But you know, really what Omar touched on, if you're a good brewer, if you're sanitary, if you have good recipes, I think the main thing is you have to learn your system, get some semblance of consistency, because just like home brewing, just like Tom said, somebody says, you know, gosh, we would like to come in and learn what you do. I said, you're already doing what I do. You're just doing it 10 gallons. I'm doing, you know, whatever, 220 gallons. So what you really have to learn how to do is clean the bathrooms. You have to learn how, like Omar said, you have to learn how to weld. You have to learn how to tear pumps apart. Because at home, you don't have a lot of the little things that you have in the brewery. You have to, you know, make sure your glycol refrigeration is proper and your controllers that mine never work right. You have to go up and smack them to make sure they click on and stuff like that. But really, you know, I don't feel that it's absolutely necessary. I don't feel that it hurts, but I don't think it's necessary to get into it. Like Tom said, we know a lot of people who have started into it and then went later. And I think what it really does is it brushes up on the real technical end of it, a lot of the science behind it, which I know nothing really about the science of it. I know I can count yeast cells and things like that, but, you know, It's just like, I think it's like being a great home cook or a great, you know, mom and pop restaurant, but where someone's got this great, you know, whatever, jambalaya recipe. You know, they didn't go to chef school to learn how to do that, but yet the place is packed every night. So what's your thought?
I agree.
You guys need to ask her more questions.
Rick, is there anything you want to add about that?
I can add that Bill Madden went to UC Davis and the IBP exam, which is the International English Language Exam to be a brewmaster. That's great, but 15 years of brewery experience and a dozen medals on the wall make a lot more difference than that education. He's meticulous. He's hardworking. Every place he's worked, when he's left, they've gone down at least a third in the number of beers they serve because it's really hard work to keep a lot of beers on.
I can just – one quick thing on that too. You know, I went to American Brewers Guild. I know folks that went to Siebel. You know, one thing you don't learn is how to use a tri-clamp, how to run a pump, all the things that – you know, it's all theoretical, which is great, but you don't know how to work at a brewery. And it can be a lot of money to go to those also. You know, you don't need a volunteer at your local brewery or brew pub. There are probably a lot of people that want to do it. Pay them $1,000 for you to work there a month for free, because that's where you're going to learn how to run a brewery, not learning, you know, sort of yeast morphology.
Is a cask or real ale business made any money yet?
For us, it's certainly, I guess, you know, I don't usually put a dollar amount on our ROI on anything. It's one of the things we've did. Not many people in Minnesota were doing it. I think Bell's was doing it when we started. And the brew pubs, obviously, but as far as packaging breweries, they weren't. And that's something, that was our marketing in the beginning. We would have pins at bars and have release parties, and that's what got people excited. So for us, it's kind of, you know, the marketing aspect of it, I guess. But no, it's way more work than you get out of it. And I busted my firkin at Pro Brewers Night and ended up with a pants full of beer. So that didn't work very well either.
The real ale is a big thing for our location. We've got 6 beer engines. At least 3 beers we'll have on at all times. But real ale can be a real gimmick. Steve Hamburg's going to talk this afternoon about it. And I hope he gets a little bit angry about it, because when I get a milkshake in my glass and it tastes like sour crap, I get pissed off. And for us, we've got a brewer that has experience with it, who sells 3 firkins of porter a week at his previous location. And you have to do it right. When the brewer goes home at night, those firkins will be locked up, and no bartender will ever touch them. Because the brewer makes the firkins, the brewer makes the real ale, the bartender pulls the beer engine. And you can't not have that meticulous oversight on it. And it's labor. Your labor costs are much higher. We're going to charge the exact same amount for a pint of real ale as we do for our draft beers. For us, it's a differentiator. It's a reason for people to come by. And it's a reason to evangelize on a beautiful, fresh craft product that you can't get anywhere else. In our market, there's a few places that try to do real ale, but you know, unless you're at Church Key and you've got a real, you know, nationally recognized beer sommelier, or you're at Pratt Street Ale House in Baltimore, it's not real ale. It's beer coming out of a beer engine that tastes better when it's on draft.
I'd say it makes more sense for a small brew pub to do it than a packaging brewery or a big brewery restaurant, just simply because I think in a small brew pub, I think we have more control over it. We can make sure that it doesn't get, you know, old and cardboardy and whatever. And we can cheat, too. We don't have to follow the strict camera guidelines of no extraneous CO2. I mean, you can put the cask breathers on there and keep those things protected so they're going to last you for a week or until they run out. So they're not getting air in them and starting to spoil. You know, and as far as the milkshake that Rick was talking about, I apologize for anybody who got a mouthful of hops Thursday night. The black IPA, you know, it was shaking around a little bit coming up from Ohio. So,
would anybody here complain about a mouthful of hops? I just want to. No? Okay. Did you have a question?
I do.
Sure.
The structure for homebrew investors.
Yeah, so the way we're structured, we're a Virginia LLC. Virginia is the most business-friendly state on the planet, which means it's sort of, you know, hostile to individuals to some extent. We're set up so that a traditional family-run business, you have to own 50.1% in order to maintain control. We're set up so that we're run as essentially a corporation, and our CEO, Bill Madden, who owns 40% of the company, has control of the company because he can appoint a majority of the board members. Those board members are independent once they're appointed because you have to have oversight. We have open book accounting for all of our investors. They can come by and check things out. We originally started out with a $50,000 minimum and raised about half our money that way, but a lot of people can't write a $50,000 check. That was to some extent to maintain the total number of investors. We lowered that to a friends and family $10,000 minimum investment, and that's when most of the homebrewers come in. I will say that our largest investor is a homebrewer, and our smallest investor is a homebrewer. These are people, you know, some of them are federal retirees, and they're not used to doing private equity investments. Very few people are. But the key here is once you explain to them that your federal retirement is really worth about $2.1 million as an annuity, and you really are an accredited investor, you can do that. The key here is that you have to make sure, and this is my seventh business, you have to make sure that all the owners, all the employees, all the managers are incentivized exactly the same way. And there's this business thing that you learn after a little while is that if you spend less money than you bring in, you get to keep it. And it gets distributed. And what we do, we have two classes of investors, our Class A investors, which are all the people that wrote checks except for me because I was in early, get 100% of their investment paid back. They get a 5% preferred return before any of the Class B investors, which are the founders, get a penny. So there's some advantages to that. It pays you back your own money so you don't pay tax on it. It's not profit. And your basis goes down to zero. Now, a lot of companies say, okay, we paid back your investment, and now I want the equity back. No, we don't do that. You get to keep it forever, and then you get your pro rata distributions. Distributions are great because it's not profit, it's net capital proceeds. Now, I'm going to go into geek speak for a second. Net capital proceeds is not what you pay tax on, it's what you get to keep. And not paying tax is the trick. We're structured to minimize the tax impact on people. We learned a lot of lessons. I love Victory Brewing Company, but they've had some, call it unfunded tax liabilities in the past. And so we've learned from a lot of folks that have done really well. Now, those Victory investors, their distribution for 2009 was greater than their original investment. And that's pretty good.
So the regulations,
yeah,
I'm sure.
TTB. Used to be ATF, now Taxation Trade Bureau. Go to their website, ttb.gov. They're great. Though on their website, I think it says don't apply for 60 days before you think you're going to open. That's really four months at least. You go into the website. You can download a packet. You're basically going to. It's a checklist you'll go through and you'll fill out the forms in triplicate. When you do that, you know, lay it out on the floor to make sure you've got everything right. You've got it all signed. It's all dated. For us, you know, once was Colorado Boy Brewing Company, Inc., and the other time I think I signed it at Colorado Boy Brewing Company, Incorporated, and that wasn't good, you know, because it's got to follow the exact same thing. So you just go through all this stuff, but that's not a big deal. They're really helpful. When you send it off, you're going to wait 2 or 3 months, and they will they'll call you and they'll say, oh, you didn't put INC, you put incorporated. Will you sign a piece of paper and blah, blah, blah? And you do it, and they'll work you through it. But the thing is you're not supposed – if you're planning on opening, let's say, May 1st, and you don't get your TTB license till May 1st, you really can't open because you need at least 6 weeks to brew some beer before you open. So you've just got to plan that in. Your state is going to be a totally different. I'm in Colorado. I say we've got to be the most beer-friendly state. I mean, it is just as easy as can be. But the TTB, that's where you start. Get that stuff. If you had to do a checklist to do a brewery, your first thing is you find your location. Your second thing is file your company, either LLC or corporation. I like corporations, but I'm not a lawyer. And set up your bank account, and then go ahead and start applying for that stuff right away, just to get it, just so that while you're putting the equipment together and doing everything else, all the paperwork's filed, because it takes a little bit to do that.
Speak to that a little bit. TTB was great to work with and pretty straightforward. You know, it's all set up what you need to do. I think for us, it was far more difficult to work with through the state stuff. One of the probably the good things for Tom is being in Colorado, they know what they're doing when it comes to beer. You know, in Minnesota, we've got four packaging breweries. The ag department is the one that controlled us. It took me a while just to figure out who is it, the ag department or who exactly gives us a license. And it's pretty common that you end up teaching them about brewing because they don't inspect breweries or brew pubs. They don't know what's going on. And, you know, we had some kind of long, drawn-out arguments with them of, like, no, you can use a plastic shovel to clean out the mash tun. That's okay. It doesn't get into the beer. And he asked us, like, well, how do you make sure you don't have metal in your beer? Well, we don't put it in, but, you know... I mean, he's used to dealing with you know, giant food production facilities like Kraft that have magnets and all that. So it takes that was for us very difficult. And I don't know, Rick, how are things going for you at the state level?
Well, you know, Renee at TTB was great. Her kids had Mad Fox temporary tattoos on them. Sent them little things. It can't be more than $25, and our T-shirts are worth less than that. And they will put temporary tattoos on their office workers if you send them. State, Virginia, I mean, they brought our favorite ABC guy out of retirement because they were really busy. And he walked through our brewery in 11 minutes and signed off on it. And then asked for background checks on all our board members and copies of their driver's license while one of our board members was in Europe. You never know. A bigger issue is construction, permitting. That's been a bigger issue. Our bigger issue was we're in a mixed-use development. I mentioned we had the most expensive brewery flue on the planet. It's double-jacketed stainless steel with fire wool between the middle. Things like that we had to do that were challenging. We had a $7,000 flue in the budget, not a $47,000 flue. It's things like that that come into play. It's all the electrical work. It's we didn't get our temporary occupancy permit on Wednesday because they had the permit for the plumbing inspection the next day in the system, and even though we hadn't had it, didn't have to pay it, the catch-22 begins. You can't get your occupancy permit without your health permit. You can't get a health permit without a business license. It all goes on there. So the best thing you can do is to make friends with the people at the city hall. And if you're in a small city or you're working with individuals, it's better than if you're going to a whole floor of city planners and trying to deal with that.
She asked. I'll be able to explain this correctly. One of the things that we did run into, too, is I think Omar said something a little bit earlier about, you know, check into everything. We were given some bad advice by the folks in our state saying that we did not have to serve food. So when we were ready to open, then we were asked where our food service license was. By the same state agency that told us we did not have to have a food service license. So that delayed us a month. It's just another thing that you need to be aware of, that you might get some bad advice from that state agency or someone at an agency level. So definitely double check everything out. Check online, like Tom said, and make sure you read everything so that you know exactly what you have to do.
So, Drew, do we have to get out of here? Pick Andrew Drew.
I'll say one more thing about that. I agree with these guys. TTB was golden. Our regional office was in Cincinnati, and yeah, Bob Adams, and he was more than helpful. It was easy. The state again. Every state is totally different. I mean, totally different. So you can't ask somebody in Virginia how to go about getting their state license if you live in Massachusetts, because it's like Mars and Venus. I mean, it's way out there. What helped us with what Rick touched on, building departments, local things like that, local health departments. Man, if you go in, you got the little calf eyes and going, oh, we're going to open a brewery. What do we need to do? Then they feel real important, and they'll bend over backwards to help you. don't walk in any office saying, we're going to do this, because they'll say, no, you're not. So that was we learned that real quick and real easily. I mean, it was helpful. So, but yeah, really, really check into the state regulations, because that's where you're going to run into a lot of your roadblocks.
One other thing is that if you put in a bathroom for your brewer, it has to be ADA accessible. So we have the most expensive brewer's bathroom on the planet.
Small town problems.
Lack of customers. But you know, I mean, we have a town of 800 or so. Probably the bulk of our customers are 100 of them, you know, and then the others are occasional. But then we get the tourists that come through. But the small town thing, which touches kind of on what these guys have been saying, is our city council. They're all homebrewers. I mean, so they were totally for it, and it's a real positive thing to have a brewery in a town. You know, you become the center of social things that happen, which can be positive or negative. I tried to start this kind of stupid thing on about mandatory voting in Ridgeway that made national news, and it got me a lot of hate mail, but. The town really, it's a big plus for the town, a small town, because you become the big fish in the little pond. So yeah, go for it. I mean, you know, but involve all those people from the very beginning, and then when you're ready to open, don't just open the doors cold turkey. Take a week and then start serving people invited, and get them involved in the whole thing to work with all your staff, so they get used to serving, so they get used to cooking food. So that when you finally open, you've got some experience and you've made all these friends along the way.
Drew.
Yeah. I got a question. So, building on that, real quick, we just had a brewery open up in LA, and they went through months and months of hassle. And their biggest challenge actually wasn't so much the city or the state, it was actually their local community. So, I'd be curious to know if you guys had any challenges with your local community, like people like, oh, you're good at bringing gangs and drunken people.
Lori, do you want to comment on that and say what you were?
Yeah, actually, it kind of goes to both. One of the best things that we did was to bring people in, because you're going to educate them so that they are going to know that what you're doing is good for the community, not bad. We had joggers when we were installing equipment running by who were like beating on the window wanting to know what we were doing, when we were going to open. There was an event in our building before we opened, before we had brewed any beer, and we had some kegs of homebrew and we were giving it away, and we were saying this is similar to what we might brew, you know, so that all of those people are excited about it, they want to be there. We hosted a travel and tourism team meeting through our local convention visitors bureau before we had our floor in. Jay taught a homebrew class before we had a bar in. So the more people you get involved from the beginning, the better.
And Jay was saying last night that you guys have like local artwork on the walls and in the building.
Yeah, community involvement is paramount, especially if something like you're going to do in a really small town. We have a lot of art in our town. For a small town, we have a big art community. We were just, you know, excited to offer them a place to display their work. We have a revolving art display every 2 months. Whatever artist it is, they have it for 2 months, and the stuff's for sale. It's an informal thing. We have openings for the new artists where we'll have a little bit of food brought in, and we might hire an acoustic guitar player to sit in the corner. So it's really positive. We had Rotary events in our brew pub before we opened. We spoke at other local clubs, civic clubs, things like that. Yeah, I think really letting the public know is a big deal, because in some places it's still kind of strange, like Drew pointed out. You know, they think all of a sudden you're going to have, you know, 47 drunks laying in the street just because you're a brew pub. You know, that's down the street at the, you know, wherever at the bar. What Rick touched on with us, we were in what in our state's called a planned unit development. We didn't have to go through any zoning. It was already cleared. It was a multi-use facility. It could be anything. We have dance studios, artist studios. We have a local developmentally disabled adult daycare. We have condos all in our building. We didn't have to do any zoning at all. All we did was move in. So these are all things to take into consideration because you will have to be zoned. In our state, if you're within like 100 yards of a church or school, the church or school has so many days to say, no, we don't want a brew pub there. We don't want a bar there. If you have a liquor permit in our state, you have to be approved if you're that close to someplace. We're not, but it's something to keep in mind.
I'll touch on our special situation a little bit. We're in the City Falls Church. There's 11,000 residents. Yeah, there's 390,000 people within 5 miles, but this is the people that are fighting. If you've ever heard of Tyson's Corner, Virginia, they're fighting against becoming the planned dense development along the main streets with they want to have a village feel. And they're really concerned that a place, you know, we can't live on those 11,000 people. We're going to be a destination. They're concerned about the traffic. They're concerned about people peeing in the streets. They're concerned about all the kinds of things they're afraid of. And our biggest approach was to bring people in and show them and meet the people so that they have the phone, the business card, the phone number, they call you up, and they will call you. The other thing I definitely recommend is you set expectations early on that you're not going to open in 3 months. The most recent editorial in local newspaper called us a failure because Chipotle opened first. And our response was if you want Chipotle, there's another one 2 miles down the street. If you want Bill Madden's nationally recognized beer, you're going to have to wait a little while for it. And those expectations, those people banging on the doors and everything else, if you set expectations early on that you're going to open in 2 years and you open in 19 months, you're a success. But if you say you're going to open in 12 months, you open in 13 months, you're a failure.
Yeah, I would agree. It's pretty par for the course that breweries always open up later than when they're supposed to. So we dealt with that to ourselves. Like, why aren't those guys opening? But, we had the issue in Brooklyn Center where the brewery is. When I was first, after came up with the idea of opening the brewery, one of the first things I did was start looking at the city ordinances. Breweries were prohibited from being in the city, so we had to convince the city council to change the law to allow breweries to operate. And obviously that was one of my main concerns, that they would just think, be just a bunch of drunks hanging out and be a problem. But certainly seems like the status of craft beer continues to keep evolving and changing, all for the good. And I was surprised everyone in the city council was very excited, and their only issue was if we had enough parking. So hopefully that's something people have a little understanding of what's going on with brew pubs and the craft beer scene these days.
Start smaller.
Maybe you should talk to Tom.
Yeah, the question, what would we do differently? I don't know. It's been an interesting ride. It's been a lot of fun. From our point only, Tom seems to be pretty organized. We didn't have a plan. We bought a brew house and we're driving home with the U-Haul, and I said, where the hell are we going to put this? I mean, really. We built a brand new garage for our house. Well, the cars went back outside. So you might want to have a space in mind first. That might be something that I would probably change.
I would have said I would have tried to get this whole thing going earlier. I mean, it's been, we all make the decisions and you try and make the best ones you can at the time. And, of course, after the fact, half of them are like, well, that was not a good idea at all. But you live with them, you try and do the best. But, I mean, it's been, for us, it's been a complete blast. And the beer business is a fun one. I'm dropping my kids off, I've got to leave the park with my kids are playing. I tell the other folks, I got to go to work. I got to go to a bar. It's a fun business, but it's tough, but it's a lot of fun.
I just want to say, since this is the last of the breweries in a progression, I'm there. I figured out for me what's perfect for me in this a small brewery that's simple. I mean, I have no regrets. That's why, again, I'm encouraging everybody, if you've got a dream to do a brewery, it is the best job in the world. I mean, I have a part-time job. I work as a park ranger 2 days a week. Oh. So when I'm not doing that, I'm brewing beer. But, I mean, I'm totally dialed in. So
now you.
Day before I flew here, I before I got on the largest checks I've ever written to partner with an experienced, award-winning craft brewer. He and his wife are maintaining majority ownership, of course, but they needed about 90% of the capital, which, of course, I'm part of that. So I've invested in this. They started by getting a casual dining Mexican restaurant, about 50 seats. And the system we're going to start building any day now, we've got all the approvals and everything, is a 10-barrel system. Do you think 10 barrels is a bit of a large size for such a small restaurant?
No. No, 10 barrels, good.
Absolutely not.
With a 10-barrel system, you can always brew 5 barrels. You know, with a 5-barrel system, you know, you're stuck. So, no, 10 barrels is great. 10 barrels, you can always go to 20-barrel fermenters, serving tanks. And that's you're perfect. Stay with that.
That's good. It's really too about the location. We got all the approvals and everything, but we call the Devil's Triangle. It's between a preschool, a church, and a police station.
Put in some bike racks.
Is it a Catholic church?
You know, when it comes to sizing a brew house, I read this early on. I think it was Flying Fish has a back, at least back in 2005 when I was working on getting this thing going. They, on their website, they had lessons in starting a brewery, which I would go by once a week and look at it again and be like, oh, right. I got to remember all that. But one thing they had on there was as far as sizing a brew house, you get the biggest one you can afford, but don't spend too much. Because, I don't think any brewery ever – I can think of maybe a couple breweries in the country I know that, like, they've got a 50-barrel system and, you know, they're not selling any beer. But I don't know if they would sell any beer if they had a 10-barrel system. You know, having a bigger brew house, you know, it takes the same amount of beer time to brew to homebrew than it does to brew 30 barrels. So all you're doing is driving down your production costs. So usually it's as big as you can afford. But
everybody's expanding.
And business, everyone's growing.
Yeah, we'll agree. We have a 7-barrel system. When we were first starting and looking, I'm thinking, you know, I'd like to find a 5-barrel system someplace. I was looking at converted or dairy equipment to convert, as Tom's Frankenbrew points out. And that was available. We had a great used equipment supplier right in Columbus, Ohio, that had literally hundreds and hundreds of used tanks that we could have used as mash tins and fermenter, open square fermenters, things like that. So it just became a point where, okay, do I want to do all this work to convert this stuff, or do I, you know, so we kept looking. Like I say, the system fell into our lap. I wish I had a 10-barrel system right now. And we're only doing, you know, 400-plus barrels this year. But, yeah, the biggest you can afford to put in that space that doesn't make it ridiculous. I mean, obviously, if you got a room, you know, 1,000 square feet, you don't want a 60-barrel brew house in it, because then you're not going to have room to do anything. But... yeah, a 10-barrel system is wonderful. I mean, that's almost the perfect pub system in my book. I mean, 7-barrel is great. But, yeah, I mean, the one thing, too, about a large size, if you've got a 20- or 30-barrel brew house and you're only doing 400 barrels a year, you know, your beer's going to be sitting around a little while in the kegs unless you do partial batches or partial, you know, a 15-barrel on a 30-barrel brew house or something like that. So a lot of considerations, but I think that's a great size.
So in a community of 10,000 people, how big of a brewery do you need? How do you figure that out, square footage wise?
It depends. I mean, are you going to have a full service restaurant? Are you going to package? I mean, you're talking about a brew pub, so you're talking about food. 2,500 square feet, 3,000. I don't do business plans.
Our 15-barrel system takes up 1,500 square feet. We have 180 barrels of fermentation. We do double batches. If we were to do this just to serve 10,000 people, I mean, the brew house is still going to take up a lot of space. You know, you look at a stacked mash tun, hot liquor tank. You know, you look at a kettle. If you can, some of these monoblocks can work okay. But look at your location. You know, do you have natural gas? Do you have to go with an electric system? You know, there's 3-barrel monoblocks you can use that are real small that are made to fit in spaces. Look at the most recent power hour that the Brewer Association did with the folks from Iron Hill and Elysian. Two very different approaches. Iron Hill does the smallest brewery they can fit to serve their location. So really, you need to look at your production, how much beer you need to make, and look at what your your time is. We do a 28-day cycle on our colch and a 14-day on our ale. That tells you what your total output's going to be. You know, look at labor. You know, Tom gets a lot of brewery in a really small space. We get a lot of brewery in 1,500 square feet. It's, you know, sizing to your market. It comes back to a lot of market research again. You know, how many people do you have within, if you're going to be open for lunch, a 10-minute drive, if you're going to be open for dinner and feed people, you know, a 15-minute drive. You know, 15-minute drive in North Dakota is 15 miles. In Washington, D.C., it's a mile and a half.
The another thing I would add to that is our seven-barrel system, when I put it in, and if you when you guys check this out online and see the slides, I have people saying, gosh, you've got a lot of room in your brew house. I mean, we made a lot of room in our brew house. We can walk around tanks. Well, I actually just added new tanks, and now they're closer together. But, I mean, we can move around. A lot of people are really jammed tight. So, I mean, depends on how your comfort level in the brew house, too. I mean, most of the breweries I go into, the fermenters are touching, and they have to, like, go clear around to go behind and stuff like that. But you could probably put a small brewery, depending on what your output. If you want to do a small brew pub with a 7 or a 10 barrel system, I mean, ours is probably sitting with room to spare in way under 1,000 square feet. I mean, and we've got it spread down along a wall and fermentation up front. So, but yeah, we could fit it in a lot tighter space. So, you know, get your tank dimensions, look at what you want to do, how much brew house do you need, how much cellarant do you need, where is your refrigeration going to be?
Ceiling
height's important. We didn't touch on that.
Ours look like cigars, 30 barrels, we've got 20-foot ceilings.
Yeah, I think if you go into space, taller ceilings better, because if you start out with sevens, you can pull a 7 out and stick a 15 in, because they got about the same footprint, maybe a little more diameter, but they go up. So you can double your capacity in the same footprint just by changing the tank in the same, you know, physical space. So tall ceilings are great.
Are we winding down, Drew?
For starting a company, we had two big bumps in investment. And in both cases, one was picking a location, and that was worth about $500,000, bringing people in. The second was lining up a bunch of beers, bringing in all those people that were just thinking about investing, filling them up full of beers, and letting them see the excitement and see the space and how it was coming along. And that was worth another $500,000. And that's what took us to close. So you have to get out there and sell. Unless you're going to write a check to do the whole thing, you have to get people in and get them excited. And Jay and Lori talked about how they did some of that. Homebrew is a great way to show the potential. Most people don't know the difference between homebrew and craft beer because, to be perfectly honest, sometimes the homebrew is better.
I think maybe one of the biggest things for us to really – was getting the community involved. And Lori worked in the community for a while as a journalist, and she knew a lot of people. And when we started this, kind of unbeknownst to us, the word was out in town long before we even, you know, could even think about what our opening date was. So people started calling us and saying, you know, we'd like to hold this at your brew house. You know, we'd like to have this meeting here. We'd like to have our group in here. Can we have a catered lunch brought in? Something like, as Lori touched on earlier, our tap room, we had sheathing down and plastic furniture that we threw in there, and yeah, come on in. And we had the convention and tourism board come in, hold their meeting. They had a great time. They're looking there at the stainless equipment, and they're sitting in an unfinished space, but they're seeing the potential. We're right on a river, so we have a small outdoor patio. I think that's paramount. People love outdoor seating. So, I mean, that's my opinion. I think the community, once we got the community involved, I think that was what really got us going.
Not $3 per square foot.
Well, $3 per square foot helped. Well, our landlord. Yeah, get a landlord that just loves you. There you go. That's a good one, too.
I guess the thing that made it all come together for me was the very first night we opened and the people that came in and said, no, but I should have, because all these people came in and they said, God, we've been waiting for this forever. And I was like, wow, how satisfying to be able to fill a need doing something that you love to do.
I think for us, it actually happened when I was at my folks' cabin in northern Minnesota, and my wife was working, so she was at home, and she called me, and she's like, oh, my brother just called, and it's our anniversary, so happy anniversary. I'm like, oh, right, sorry, I forgot, too. But she was online, and she said, oh, yeah, Beer Advocate's got this top 50 breweries in America list, and she was kind of going through it. I'm like, well, who's on it? And she kind of went through, and I guess someone saw the magazine before they put it online. You know, I'm sure a number of people read it, and, you know, they don't have it all online, and someone on there said, well, you know, take a guess who's number one, and a bunch of breweries, people guessed, and it ended up that it was us as the number one American brewery in 2007. So for us, that was kind of a big, it was a pretty pretty big moment for us to get that recognition. So that's when things really seemed to think things were going to work out.
Last word, Tom.
Well, this kind of goes against everything I've said so far, but compared to anything I've done in the past, we own the building, and that's a totally separate deal. You know, we control it. It feels good. You know, the building was built in 1915. It's historic. It's got an ancient bar in it already there. But you know, when I rip up the floor, I do something. I go, this is mine, and that's very satisfying to me. So, anyway, last word. Don't put it off. Open a brewery.
Thank you all.
How great is it that these brewers stayed for so long to answer questions and to give such valuable advice? That's one more reason why you should go to yourself to these conferences. Just my opinion, of course. And next year it's going to be in San Diego. So what other excuse do you need? If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And I apologize, I'm still digging from the backlog of being on vacation, so please be patient. You can check out our homebrewing DVDs, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. We've got combo deals to save you a couple of bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in our store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online for us in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Arms Reach Natural Original Co-Sleeper and Reef Men's Reef Slap 2 Flip Flop Black, size 11M, US. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support greatly. Also, don't forget about the associate links to the American Homebrewers Association and Brew Your Own magazine as well. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.